sometimes it's quite hard to explain to people the idea that there's a patriarchy or that it's systemic, especially if they're blind to it. And then every now and then you get a filter that is just so revealing. It's like page after page of gut punches of men actively working as hard as they can to stop women doing things. Now, where you would never expect to find this is in a history of Australian soccer. It's called Never Say Die, the 100-year overnight success of Australian women's football. And it's written by Dr. Fiona Crawford and Dr. Lee McGowan. Good morning.
Good morning.
Why did you want to do this?
My two daughters are both huge football fans, and they started asking me questions about when women started playing, how long they've been playing for. But the key question was about parity. Why do women have to work all week and then play football on the weekend when men get paid a full-time wage for it? So that was about 4 or 5 years ago. And at the time, Fiona and I were working together on some stuff around the Homeless World Cup, and Fiona's PhD as well. And so Fiona has an unbelievable knowledge about women's football. So it just seemed like a natural thing for us to join our complementary knowledges, because I knew about the history and Fiona's across the contemporary issues. And so I think we've both learned a lot from each other.
As you went through the archives, Fiona, were you just shocked at how sort of rampantly sexist all of these stages of the history are?
Yeah, it really was. So I've had the benefit or the good fortune to work with the Matildas and the W League really closely. I was working with them between about 2010 and 2012. And so I thought I had some insight, because I actually saw it firsthand, and I saw how hard the players were working and how generous they were with their time, even though they were working and studying full time and then trying to juggle this football training load on top of it. But it wasn't until we actually really started to dig in that we got a real sense of it. So I was surprised as anybody.
Let's talk about the 1920s, Lee. What exploded then?
Oh, it was really the First World War in the United Kingdom. The factory owners were missing an important source of revenue, because all the men had gone to the trenches, obviously, and the changing workforce with the female workers coming in. The women were playing football in their lunch hour, and these kind of stogie-smoking factory owners thought, oh, there's an opportunity, we could sell tickets for this instead. And that's really where things started. So you see women playing football in the UK and in France from about 1916. And then in 1920, 21, women's football was, if not as popular, possibly more popular than men's football. And so the all-male men's football association, the English Football Association, decided they might have to make some changes. And so they banned women from playing football in the 1920s. By that time, women had started playing here in Australia, and there had been a few games prior to 1921, but 1921 is the year where we really see the game exploding. I think there was as many as 12 teams in southeast Queensland alone.
And Fiona, I mean, that happened again in the 70s, these bans where the organising bodies just go, no, actually, women, you can't play.
Yeah, it's really quite interesting, because I am a child of the 80s, and I used to watch my brother play football, and I ate a lot of lollies on the sidelines, but I never actually played. And the reason I didn't play was because I couldn't see anyone playing, which is what I've learnt through writing this book. Was actually it was a legacy of this ban, where they actually tried to actively discourage players from playing. So what you're actually seeing now, particularly with the current generation of Matildas, is you are seeing the last generation of players who were the only girls on the boys' team and who were playing despite the fact that they were being actively discouraged from playing. And we're also seeing the first generation who were, you know, coming through and actually got to play on girls' teams.
In this world of going, what's all your fuss about, you weird feminists? So you're listening to Dr. Fiona Crawford and Dr. Lee McGowan, authors of a book, Never Say Die, the 100-year overnight success of Australian women's football. But what it is inadvertently actually is a documentation of 100 years of really coordinated, rampant sexism directed against women just trying to play a game. Why did a lot of the early leagues, the women, want no publicity in the press? And what did the press do whenever they spoke about them? Because this is so revelatory as well.
Aye, in the 1920s in particular, you know, you can, well, even before that, the football was aligned with the suffragette movement in the United Kingdom, and was used as a vehicle to promote the franchise and encourage women to choose to wear what they wanted to wear, because obviously you couldn't play football while you were wearing a dress, makes it kind of difficult. And then and so you see this kind of political movement starting to align itself with the game, or at least the two things converging. And then in the 1920s, the four key reasons that women were banned from playing football really was because initially they said it was for medical reasons. You know, obviously the men were concerned about the women's reproductive organs, and so that's based on a medical journal article that was published in The Lancet. And then they were obviously worried about the aesthetics as well, you know, the unseemliness of women playing sport that was deemed to be a masculine sport at the time. And then when they found out how much money the women's game was making, and then having the audacity to give that money away to charity, that obviously motivated the men to do something about it. They were obviously losing money. But then the final stroke was the miners' strike. In 1921 in Northeast England, the women had decided to raise money for the striking miners' families through playing football, and that was really the kind of that overt political association and anti-establishment activity was seen as something that couldn't be tolerated any longer. So the women were banned. Women still played football. They paid less attention to the ban here in Australia, but. Yeah, they were actively, well, they certainly weren't encouraged to play football at any point. And then you see in the 60s, there's games, women's teams forming in Sydney, in Melbourne, and the first league competition happened here in Brisbane. And really, that was in spite of the men's clubs and the men's activities. It was because women wanted to play football, so they took the ball in their own hands.
There's some amazing stories in this book, Fiona, of the administrators of the contemporary game who are the absolute pioneers, because you don't get sport without having the club and the association. Who are some of those really towering figures?
Yeah, so I mean, the recent 2019 Women's World Cup is one example. So there was actually an Australian woman in charge of the grand final and the venues. So she moves very quietly behind the scenes, and you know, on a good day, no one would know she's actually there. But her name is Jo Fernandez. She actually was the Matildas manager for 13 years. So she was the person who kept the Matildas running behind the scenes when there was absolutely no money and no media coverage as well. And she's actually gone on to now be what they call a general coordinator with FIFA. So she, yeah, turns up to every World Cup and runs the venues. And that's everything from making sure the change rooms are fine to making sure the hotels are fine to making sure that, you know, the music and the right advertising and all sorts of things. So it's a huge job, and she's phenomenal at it.
And you have to imagine where, for a lot of men, you know, careers can be made doing those sports and you accrue status and power and money. Most of those women would have been doing it for free.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you've seen players, for example, Moya Dodd is another example. She's actually been named, I think, the seventh most powerful woman in sport in recent times. But again, another quiet achiever. So she's a former Matilda. There was no money in the game, so she actually went and became a lawyer. She's now a partner at one of the top law firms in Sydney. But she's actually continued to give back to the game. So she's been a board member for the Football Federation Australia, and she's actually gone on to be co-opted to the FIFA Executive Committee as well, which is essentially the top governing body committee in the world. But she is tireless in her advocacy of players, and things like the pay parity, which recently came through, you can really put down to some of the hard work of people like Moya Dodd behind the scenes.
Are we through? Are we in a modern era of the game now that's distinctly different from the sorts of battles that have been fought in the past?
Yes and no. Yes. So I would like to say yes, and we're never going to go back. Mm-hmm. But I think we also need to not take this pay parity and rest on our laurels. There was enormous amounts of hard work, and this has been probably 100 years in the making for the pay parity to be achieved in recent weeks. And I think there's still more work that can be done. So I think, but also the players there know, just how much work has gone into it. So they will certainly be championing it for the next generations too.
There's definitely examples of massive backlashes in history though, aren't there, with leagues developed and then abolished and, you know, underwritten and things. And that, I think, as a dad of daughters, Lee, I mean, do you feel some shame about that?
Oh, look, that's, I think, what drove me to look at this process in the first place. Like, as I said, I remember my eldest, Hannah, asking me about... We were actually at a game with Fiona, and Hannah had said to me, "Dad, why are the female players not as good as the main players? You know, this is 5 years ago." Mm. And, you know, and I said to her, "Well, I think it's because, you know, they have to work all week. They don't, they have to pay their own expenses. They don't get wages. Well, the men get a full-time wage. They get leave. They get sick pay. They have masseuses looking after them, dietitians, trainers, people cleaning their boots, you know." And
someone
and
told me once that each AFL player has 17 professionals dedicated to them.
There you go. That's incredible statistic, isn't it? And as I was actually answering this question to Hannah, who was 12 at the time, I really started to realise myself as like a fat Scottish dad, you know, how much privilege we have in the...
Yeah.
And so that's, for me, really, that's the unfairness of it alone is just really incredible. I think, coming back to Fiona's, that point that Fiona made earlier, you know, the yes and the no, I think there are still forces within the game trying their best to ensure that the male game, it's not about discrimination of the women's game, I think, as much as it's about ensuring that the male game is protected, which is really short-sighted, because the women's game's bringing a brand new audience. You know, it's bringing, like that, the Matildas game in Sydney 2 weeks ago, 20,000 people at it. There was 80,000 people watching England versus Germany at Wembley the same day. You know, the people are paying good money now to go and watch what's a fantastic product. The women are absolutely at the top of the game in terms of world football. And I think that's the part that people are missing. That we've always been told that people don't want to watch it, or it's not as good, and all these stupid reasons for not wanting to encourage women's football. But actually, it's as good a football as you'll watch anywhere in the world. And
well, I've always felt like you can't make that judgment till you've invested in it for 100 years, you know, and then
exactly
whether
right.
it's as good
exactly
or not.
Right.
Fiona, yeah. What's the future?
So the future, probably one of the first things that needs to be enacted, and there was actually an article this morning that I saw that Moya Dodd was championing a 30% female representation on decision-making bodies, so, for example, on boards. And one of the points that she makes, which we include in the book, is that even when she was there at FIFA, she was co-opted, so she didn't really have a vote, and she was also representing a constituency that didn't have a vote. So basically everyone in the room was male, and it wasn't necessarily always that they wanted to discriminate against women. It's that when you don't have a background in women's football, it just doesn't occur to you, or you don't know what you don't know. Mm. So probably one of the first things that needs to happen is, that 30% representation, not because they're making up quotas, but because they actually need the voices in the room for people who actually understand what they need to do for the game.
Just to be good managers, you need all the pictures of the people who are involved, and you need to hear their voices. And we're hearing that in so many parts of society. But in this case, that's Dr. Fiona Crawford and Dr. Lee McGowan, their book Never Say Die, The 100-Year Overnight Success of Australian Women's Football, shines a real light on fighting systemic patriarchal sexism through the code of football. Great to talk to you both, guys.
Thank you very much.